AWA Unleashed. We are the preeminent AWA podcast. I'm Chris Tubbs. This is a special broadcast. We are going out of what we normally have done. And one thing we're about on this is about stories. And you know that Mick Karch and George Shire are great storytellers. And this week, they have been able to connect with their friend and one of the all-time greats in the AWA. And, you know, a lot of people also know him from WWE and elsewhere. It is the one and the only Jumpin' Jim Brunzell joining us. And, Jim, I am beyond excited to be able to have you on this, and especially to be able to hear you talk with George and Mick. You guys were just talking before we recorded, and I love it because it just, I can tell like the natural camaraderie and the long-term friendship that you guys have. To me, this is like the ultimate in a wrestling fan's dream. So thank you for letting me come in and join it.
Well, it's funny because we're in a rare fraternity, and it varies from, you know, age to age and what group you've been with. But, you know, the fact that I was in the, you know, AWA when I started, and actually I got spoiled because I thought it was without a doubt the best territory to start in. And believe it or not, you know, Vern Gagne was very fair with all of us, and the amount of talent that he had here was second to none. I mean, we had the greatest wrestling talent in the world. And what was so nice about working in the AWA was the fact that we had time off in the summer. You know, we worked, you know, 10, 12 times a month, maybe 15, 17, you know, maybe. But everybody got spoiled. And everybody knew their position. Everybody worked hard. And everybody was happy, I think.
Yeah, a lot of lake and cabin time, and you got to take advantage of it here in Minnesota, because, you know, then we deal with the 40 below that we're dealing with, you know.
Jesus.
And you know all about it. So I'm only going to ask a few questions here. I'm going to let George and Mick pretty much just run the show.
Okay.
But, you know, like they normally like to do. But I guess what I'm going to do is I just want to, like, how did you get involved? Like, how did you decide to get into the wrestling business?
Well, it was really, I had visions of me playing in the NFL, and Greg Gagne and I were teammates my freshman year at the University of Minnesota. He was a walk-on quarterback, and I was a walk-on receiver from White Bear Lake. And we teamed up together as freshmen and did pretty well, and we had a pretty good friendship going. And after his sophomore year, Greg realized he wasn't going to play quarterback for Murray Warmap. So he transferred to Montana. I continued, to play in Minnesota and had a very mediocre career. But, you know, I, as a young kid, I remember watching, you know, the Gophers in 1961 and the Rose Bowl. And I told my grandfather, I says, someday I'm going to play on that team. And he looked at me, you know, and so it was a dream come true for me. And I still, you know, I have such great memories from my teammates at the University of Minnesota. And then what happened was, after I had tried, you know, I had a little 2-week tryout with the Washington Redskins in 1971 or whatever it was, and didn't make it, came back, and I was going to go to school. And Greg called me up and he says, geez, my dad's going to have a wrestling camp, and he's got Ken Patera, and he's got Ric Flair, and he's got Khosro Vaziri from Iran, and who else was there? Geez, Bob Bruggers, and myself and him. And I says, well, I said, I don't know very much about, you know, amateur wrestling, but I'll give it a shot. And, you know, next thing you know, I was in Moorhead, Minnesota, and I wrestled Dennis Stamp in a 15-minute draw. And I'll never forget, I came into the locker room and I thought, oh God, what a horrible match. You know, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. So I kicked this big garbage can, and Dusty Rhodes looked at me, and he looked at me and he goes, Jimmy, Jimmy, Jimmy. He says, don't worry. He says, you're going to have a lot of stinkers in your career. So he says, just learn from every one of them. And that was my beginning in, you know, pro wrestling.
All right. Who wants to take it? George, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Well, you lead right into this, Jim, when you talk about entering the AWA and your first match and that sort of thing. It was kind of traditional back in that day after Vern trained the guys that eventually they would leave the AWA and go to another territory, which also gained them a lot of experience. Mm-hmm. A lot of those guys never returned. Guys like the Anderson brothers and, you know, Ricky Steamboat, some of those guys. Now, you left for a year and you went to the Central States. And my question to you is, was that something that Vern told you you were going to do and you went down there, or did they recruit you, and why did you come back? And there you are with Mike Chore.
Oh, God, he was a good teammate and a nice guy and a good wrestler. And Gus Karras, who was, I don't know, 80-some years old, he was the oldest wrestling promoter in the United States. You know, Vern just sent me down there because there was no room for me in the AWA. I was too green, so I went down there, and we wrestled every night, twice a night. And you know, this we'd wrestle twice on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and maybe just once on Sunday. But all the towns were close, so we came back, you know, and I remember seeing the Briscoes and the Funks and, you know, that came into the Kansas City auditorium. And I watched all those guys, and there was a lot of good talent that came through there. But, you know, it's just like anything else. There's an apprenticeship, and you have to learn by experience. And the only way you get experience is by wrestling every night. Right. So I remember I was staying in an apartment, and the apartment was $145 a month. And it was, I had a inflatable mattress on the floor, and I had another inflatable mattress in case I had a guest. And once in a while, Bob Backlund came and stayed with me, and he was on his way down to Texas.
Justin, that wasn't the kind of guest you were thinking of.
No, but he stayed with me. So he blew up this mattress, and by the time he woke up in the morning, he was sleeping on the floor, and he had a stiff neck. So he had to drive.
Glad that's the only thing that was stiff.
Oh, sorry, I led you right into that one, George.
Yeah, sorry. Hey, I couldn't pass that one up.
But it, you know, I was down there for 10 months, and I really got a lot of experience. And Mike George and I became the Central States wrestling champs, and we worked with Roger Kirby and Lord Alfred Hayes.
Yeah.
And they also had Bulldog Bob Brown down there, and he was a good worker too. You know, he was from Winnipeg, and he fashioned himself after Gene Kaninsky. But yeah, it was
cool there.
Yeah. it was a good time, and you know, I thought I learned well. And I remember when I was going to come back, they sent me to Japan. And so I go to Japan. I don't know what the hell I'm doing there. But I was there in, I think, 1974. And I had a heck of a crew with me. And honest to God, it was a, you know, fight for your life every night with these young Japanese kids. And I was there for 5 weeks. So I remember Vern saying, okay, here's what the deal is. He says, you're going to make $1,200 a week. And I thought, oh boy, that's good. So when I came back, he said, well, you got to kick back to me $400. So I had to pay him, you know, $2,000. And then, you know, I wound up making, you know, $800 a week, but it was good experience. And then they wound up making Greg and I partners in 74, whatever it was, into the High Flyers. So, you know, and Greg and I had a good run. We had great talent to work with. You know, incredible talent.
That brings up a question that I'm going to follow up with then, Jim.
Okay.
With Greg, because you had so much success, and even today people talk about the High Flyers, how great they were, great team, favorites, the whole thing. Did you ever wish or think about in your career that it would have been good for you to turn heel? And maybe you and Greg have this great, hellacious feud? Because I absolutely think it would have been box office if you'd have hooked up with the Heenan family or something along those lines and had the feud with Greg.
Well, I look at it that I was the baby face. Greg would have been the heel, and his dad never would have gone for that.
There you go.
you know, people had mentioned that, you know, and I thought, well, you know, we had a good team. And like I said, we, you know, with Bockwinkel and Stevens and Duncombe and Lanza and Buddy Wolf and all those guys that we worked with, you know, it was just incredible talent. And you had a good match every night. I mean, it was funny when I went to New York, I thought, holy Jesus, you know, everybody in New York was afraid to sell because they thought they'd look weak. So it was like a fight for your night, you know, fight for your life every night.
Unbelievable. George, I got to piggyback on what you were talking about Jim turning heel. Yeah, first of all, Jim, it's criminal that you look as good as you do. I mean, it's seriously, you know, a couple of old farts here running this podcast, and you're aging in reverse. Something's not right here. But well, God bless you. You know, I mean, more power to you.
Well, here's the deal. I've been a creature of habit, and I've taken supplements all my life. And I take a lot of supplements. I take about 30 capsules a day during the day. And so far, so good. And when I told my doctor that, my doctor told me, he says, Jim, he says, I want to tell you, I know for sure. And I said, what's that? And he said, you have the most expensive urine in Vadnais Heights.
Okay.
Oh, that's a badge of honor. Getting back to what George was talking about turning heel, in my mind's eye, back in the 1970s, AWA had you turned heel. I had this vision of what I thought would be the dream team. And I think Chris has me a little small in size there, but there's you and Nick. And I believe that photograph was taken in Japan. And to me, I mean, seriously, you know, you get all these, you know, fantasy wrestling matches and scenarios and storylines in your head. I think that you and Nick absolutely would have been a phenomenal tag team together, you know, especially if somehow Vern put the tights back on and came into the ring and teamed up with Greg. Talk about box office, Jim.
Well, this was in 1981 now, and it's funny because I had left the AWA again in 1979 and went down to Charlotte and worked down there for a year and a half. And I wound up doing a little bit in Atlanta, and then I came back and again, they sent me to Japan, and I go to Japan, and Nick's on the plane with me. He says, you and I are going to be partners. And I go, oh Jesus, you know, but we had a hell of a team. Honest to God, I thought we worked good. And you know, Nick was incredible. He was, he was, you know, top three out of all the guys I ever worked with. He was just so incredible in the ring. Everything he did with his timing and everything was just, you know, magnificent. He was great.
Well, that was the reason I said maybe put you with Bobby Heenan and the Heenan family, because like you said, I always thought about this too. Greg would have been the heel in this. The fans would have cheered him. I believe that. But that's why you had to have Heenan in there and you as the heel, that I think it would have went over great.
There's another photograph, Jim, and I got to talk about this with you real briefly, because you have mentioned before that the 60-minute draws that you had with Nick in the 1970s, to me, were absolutely classic. You know, when you talk about some of the best matches in AWA history, just absolutely stellar. You had everything going for 60 minutes, and you did it, you know, several times over. What was it like in your mind's eye? You know, you've been a tag team guy for so long. Did you feel like you had kind of gone to a different level as a singles wrestler after the program with Nick?
Well, you know, like I said before, Nick was the ultimate. I mean, he was the consummate professional, and I learned more from him in the time I was in the AWA than I learned from anybody. I mean, you know, Ray Stevens was good, but I mean, Nick was, he was exceptional. And I remember that first hour draw I had with him in St. Paul. I almost died. I was so tired. I remember I was making a big comeback, and all of a sudden he punched me right in the sternum here, and I lost all my wind. And I went, and he says, come on, keep coming. I could barely, you know, breathe, and I'm trying to do this and do that. And I thought, oh. And then I had another hour Broadway with him in Winnipeg, and it was a, oh, God, it was a barn burner. Oh, my God. And I came back to the locker room, and I could barely open up a beer. I was so tired. And Mad Dog came in. He said, Jimmy, he said, that was a great match. And he walked out, and he went back in the heel room. But, yeah, Nick was incredible. And I owe a lot to him and Bobby Heenan, because they taught me more about timing and selling and coming back than anybody, you know.
Yeah. When you first started on the road, was it what you expected? Did you have any expectations of kind of what your life was going to be like?
Oh, geez. You know, I think when I started and when I was on the road, especially in Kansas City, I thought, oh boy, you know, this is, you know, making $27.50 a night for working twice in the ring. And that happened every night. And I thought, holy Jesus, I get that at the end of the week, I made $147 or something like that. And I thought, oh God, it's going to be hard to pay for that $145 efficiency apartment. So, you know, I tried the best I could at looking at the guys, you know, and like I said, I watched Jack Briscoe, who I thought was a magnificent talent. And then I watched the Funks and in Kansas City, and I watched them in the ring, and I tried to pick up, you know, I watched what they did, and I had an opportunity to, and I did work with Terry Funk, you know, I don't know how many times, 3 or 4 times. Matter of fact, I beat him in Columbus, Ohio for the Atlanta Heavyweight TV Championship, and he knew he was going to lose that night, and he never brought the damn belt, so I never got a damn belt. So I was pissed at him for that. He used to call me Sonny. He said, hey, Sonny. And I says, well, what are we going to do for the finish? And he says, we'll figure it out in the ring. And I go, oh, Jesus, you know. So that's the way, the type of guy he was, you know. He was another, oh. Both those Funk guys and the Briscoes were all naturals, you know. Jack Briscoe was incredible, too. Whoa.
All right, why don't you go ahead and George, with your next point there, Georgie.
Well, I was going to say that you're talking about coming back to the AWA. Did you have any say at all in the creative path for you, or were you just stuck with Greg and that was the way it was going to be?
That was it, baby.
So, I mean, if you'd have went to Vern, do you think if you'd have went to Vern and said, hey, you know, I got a great idea. How about I cold cock him in the ring and we have this big breakup and I'm tired of following his shadow and the Ganya shadow? I mean, it would have been such a natural feud.
My wife would have never allowed it. she would have said, oh, Jim, we can't walk in down the street. You know, people will be hating you. You know, so I don't know if I ever could have been a heel. I mean, I worked rough in Japan, but everybody had to work rough in Japan. But I just never thought, you know, the only way I could have been a heel is in New York against Vince McMahon, because that would have been a hell of a program.
Absolutely.
Well, but you could have been a heel against Vern.
Oh, Jesus.
I really...
Well, you know, I respected Vern. You know, he came from nothing and became a multimillionaire, and he was on top of the world. But in so doing, he alienated everybody around him in the different territories. He was envied and disliked by all his fellow, you know, his promoters. You know, they were all jealous of him. And
well, they had reason to be too.
Well, they did, but you know, he did it his way. Yeah. And he was pretty defiant, and it was his way or the highway. You know, I mean, honest to God, if he would have let Hulk Hogan beat Nick, you know, they would have done incredible business here. I mean, it would, and I think the fact that, here's my own idea, is the fact that Hulk Hogan, Terry Bollea was completely the opposite of Vern Gagne. You know, he was a musclehead, you know, beach boy, you know, guitar player. And it was so contrary to, you know, the AWA, you know, Mr. Collegiate All-American Vern Gagne. It just never would. That's a great picture there. And he would have, and you know, Terry Bollea could work like a son of a gun. I watched him in Japan. He could work. He worked with Inoki a couple times. It was a great, I mean, it was down on the mat and it was good, you know, and then all of a sudden he gets to New York and, you know, he does this and that, and, you know, and he, you know, without Hulk Hogan, the WWE would never be what it is today. He was the golden goose. There's no question in my mind. He was incredible.
Jim, here's a question for you, kind of piggybacking on the Vern situation and the mentality at the time. I remember this, it had to be mid-1980s when Steve Regal was in town, teaming with Jimmy Garvin. This might have been actually after they split up. Steve was doing some indie shows.
Yes.
And he said that when it came time, he left the AWA. And the reason being, he said, Vern told him, in essence, go ahead, do whatever you got to do. You need me. I don't need you. And Steve said that it wasn't even a matter of dollars and cents at that point. It was more, you know, the ego thing and the pride and the way Vern dealt with the talent. What can you say about that?
Well, that was I believe that story. And Vern was very heavy-handed when he dealt with the talent. You know, he demanded this, he demanded that, and if you didn't comply, you were gone, you know. And it was simply that way with him. And I saw, you know, a side of Vern that, in as far as, you know, being a promoter, that I really didn't, you know, appreciate. But I mean, that goes hand in hand with business. I mean, you're always going to deal with somebody in business who's been successful and has an enormous ego and has the success to show for it. And they just don't want to be questioned. So, you know, that's what you have to deal with. I mean, almost all those guys that, I mean, you know, Ole Anderson in Atlanta and then Vern in Minnesota and, you know, Vince, holy Jesus. I mean, there's the epitome of egotism right there. You know, he oh God.
Yeah. Do you remember, and I know we're primarily AWA, but this kind of ties into Vince. Do you remember your first promo in front of Vince when you were, you know, first had your shot in New York?
My first match?
Our your first interview. Role?
Oh, yeah, I do remember the interview because it was just a basic Gene Okerlund was there. And, you know, here's Jim Brunzell from Minnesota. And I'd been a tag team guy and this and that. And they're doing, you know, just a basic baby face interview. And, you know, I'm not going to scream and shout and I'm not a character, you know. So, you know, I did the best I could. And I thought, well, you know, this is the way it is. And I know I could work. So I could work with anybody there, and I did. I mean, they had guys there like Bob Orton, who was in the AWA. Great worker. Honest to God, he was incredible. And, you know, and they had some great workers in the, you know, Rick Steamboat was incredible. And I'll tell you another guy, Jake Roberts. Jake the Snake was one of the best, you know, who I had seen and in the ring. I mean, as far as timing and the stuff he did, he was, you know, he was incredible, and there was so many guys that had great talent there, but they, here's what Vince did. Vince came in, and he didn't want to sell an athletic type wrestler. He wanted to sell a gimmick so he could make money on it.
Sure.
So he'd project these guys, you know, all of a sudden he'd change their name, you know, and do this and do that, and they're going to do this, and they're going to do that. And, you know, that's, you know, like Bobby Heenan says, he says, you know what Vince has done? And I says, what? And he says, he's made a comic book come true to life in the wrestling world.
Sure.
And he was right.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you talk about Vince in that sense and Vern, you know, the difference in the two characters, the two promoters, when Vince would come to a wrestler and say, well, I want you to be a clown or I want you to be an alligator or whatever the gimmick was going to be, wouldn't it have been the same situation if you said, no, I don't want to do that, that you would be gone or you may not be elevated to, you know, where you felt you should be or could be?
You'd be gone. You'd be gone if you didn't go along with what Vince wanted. You'd be gone. You know, I mean, that was his deal. Look what he did to Adrian Adonis.
Oh yeah.
You know, Keith Franks was a great worker. You know, and then all of a sudden he makes him this guy. You know, with flour in his mouth and the you know, honest to God, it was horrible. And he did that to a couple different guys, and you just. You think, holy God. And, you know, and he'd do things like, who was it? It was Million Dollar Man with Ted DiBiase and then Virgil. Well, the Million Dollar Man was supposed to be Crockett, and Virgil was supposed to be, you know, Dusty Rhodes.
Dusty Rhodes.
So, you know, he played this little game in his mind. He says, well, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and I'm going to project this and I'm going to project that. And meanwhile, he's getting his ego, you know, brushed and patted on, because that was Vince's main goal. He wanted to just, you know, glorify his own self.
Well, here's a hypothetical for you. So with all of these characters, I know we're off a little bit about AWA here, but with these characters that Vince is creating, and of course with you, he came up with you and Brian as the Killer Bees, and you had that mask tag team.
Yeah,
you know that was a great gimmick. Actually,
it was a great gimmick.
The mask confusion.
Oh, it was a great gimmick, and they didn't go anywhere with it. You know,
well, sometimes they didn't. But would it have been possible if more guys would have said, no, Vince, we're not going to do this, and they would have went back to their respective territories or went to other territories, that maybe Vince wouldn't have had the success that he did, rather than everybody just, you know, relinquishing their soul to him and becoming whatever he wanted them to be. Terry Taylor, the Red Rooster, or whatever he was. And, you know, all the different gimmicks. Well, he took Steve Kern, a great worker, and made him Gator.
I know. The problem was, George, there was no place to go. There was no territory to go to.
In the beginning, there's
not really. No, because that's why everybody left. Look at all the guys that left the AWA.
Yeah, you're right.
All of them. There was no place. And guys left Georgia. I mean, guys left Oklahoma. They left Texas. They left California. They left Oregon because they figured we had 60 guys in the WWE when I was there. And we had three towns a night, 20 guys in each town. That's the way Vince worked, and he worked us all to death. You know, we didn't have any time off. I remember, I remember working till the time I broke my hand. What's his name? Doggone it. Valentine. Greg Valentine broke my hand in Rockford, Illinois. And he blocked. I had him in a double wrist lock, and I went to take him over, and he blocked my hand, and all of a sudden I got my hand in his hand and I'm holding it, and all of a sudden when he blocked it, I heard a pop.
Oh.
And I thought, and I broke this finger right here. Let's see, right here. And I could feel, and Valentine says, oh, Jim, what happened? I said, I broke my freaking hand, you know? So we get done with the match. I go home and I get out of the ring, and Brian's in a single match. I says, I broke my hand. He says, well, you can't go home. I said, bullshit, I'm going home. So I went home and my hand swelled up. I had to wait one day, and then they put a cast on my hand up to about here. And I came back and we won more matches when I clotheslined people with this, you know, cast around my hand, than any drop kick or any other doggone B stomp or whatever it was.
You were playing the Sheik.
Yes.
You stole a gimmick.
Yes.
I got a question for you, Jim, and it really ties into the philosophical differences between Vern and the old school and, of course, Vince McMahon, because you were one of the guys, you worked both. You transcended the eras. So when you left this environment of everything is legitimate, everything is, you know, collegiate wrestling or, you know, no cartoon characters, and you went to New York, two things. A, how did you feel personally, aside from money, how did you feel personally about making that transition? And secondly, that was all part of the breaking of kayfabe. You know, and Vern, of course, which was such a stickler and such a protector of the business. Now you're in this whole different environment. How did you feel about that?
Well, I still stayed the same way. I mean, I didn't change anything. I worked the way I normally did. And basically what happened was, here was the big deal. When you wrestled in New York, they had a New York Athletic Commission. And if it was an authentic, you know, boxing match or whatever, they charged a tax every house. So Vince told, he didn't want to pay this money. So here was the big breakdown of kayfabe in New York, was the fact that he told the Athletic, New York State Athletic Association, that it was entertainment. So they stopped charging him an athletic commission tax. So it saved him money. And basically, I think a lot of guys still, you know, lived the kayfabe deal. There was a couple times when I think it was Cosro, you know, the Iron Sheik and Jim Duggan were working on top in Asbury Park, New Jersey, home of Bruce Springsteen, and they got caught by the cops, and they had a bag of cocaine in their goddamn glove compartment. And I thought, holy Jesus, how are they going to explain this, you know? And you know what? Just like Bobby Heenan said, this wrestling profession is bulletproof. You know?
I get it, you know, and so do you think it was inevitable, you know, with the direction society was taken as a whole, that even if Vince hadn't done what he did and broken kayfabe, that the you know, the whole crash TV and people being more into violence and blah, blah, do you think it was inevitable that everything was going to come out anyway? You had the dirt sheets and everything else going even before Vince came out.
Well, I don't know if it was inevitable, but I think it was something that was just, it just kept building and building along with Hulkamania. And then you have to also look at, you know, Mick, the fact that when you're dealing on the East Coast, you're dealing with a huge population. I mean, you're dealing with, you know, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, you know, Washington, D.C., and the other places. I mean, they drew incredible because they had such unbelievable, you know, the amount of people that lived there. It was incredible. I mean, you know, I remember going into Boston Garden one night and I thought, geez, you know, these people were like the Roman gladiators. They didn't care if you were a baby face or a heel. If they didn't like you, you better be careful. Oh, look at that, George. Geez. God, I was slim there. Where was that at?
I was taken in May of 2010.
That Lakeville High School, George?
Yeah, Lakeville High School. Yeah. And Greg was working a little angle or something with one of the wrestlers on the card. And
oh, God.
We interviewed. I think I gave Chris another photo there. Were you able to load that one in, Chris, showing the interview?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Just give me a minute. I will bring that one up.
Well, anyway. That picture that you had there, George, it looked like that might have been one of the only times Greg outweighed me.
Well, Greg got into the ring that night.
Oh, God.
Against someone. And I was there. There you go.
Yeah. There it is.
Mick was interviewing him. You and I were on the sidelines there.
Oh, that's right. And he went into the ring. I told him, I says, Greg, what the hell are you doing? And he had to go in there. I think he threw a drop kick too.
He did.
I said, you know, the same thing with Brian Blair. You know, he went down that when he got inducted into the Iowa Hall of Fame. He went to work that night, and I said, Brian, what in the world are you doing? I said, you're 57 years old. And he says, ah, that's okay. It's just a young guy, you know, I'll lead him. And they go to tie up, and the guy goes to tie up and hits him with his fist right over his eye and opens him up. And from, you know, 30 seconds into the match, he's got blood dripping down. I go, oh.
I said, get that one more shot in, Jim. Yeah, one geez. More.
God. I remember the last match I had, I was 50 years old, and it was a match in Albert Lea. It was my birthday, and I was working with my old nemesis, Jim Neidhart. And Patera was the promoter, and we got in the ring, and Jim, God rest his soul, was, I think he might have been altered a little bit medically, and it was, he had a hold of my head, and I thought he was going to pop me off like a New Year's Eve bottle of champagne, my head. So after the match, I came out and I said to myself, this was my 50th birthday. I said, I'm done. I said, I can't do what I used to do. And I don't want to, you know, I just can't do this. And then, you know, I can see where guys, you know, in their body and need that adulation and hear the fans clap and say, oh yeah. There's a point in your life and your career when you cannot do what you used to do.
Right. Right.
And if you can't do it, you're robbing not only yourself, but the fans, you know? And I thought, I'm done, you know, and I remember I had some people, you know, later on say, well, you know, all we want you to do is run in the ring. I said, no, I'm not going to run in the ring. Well, we want you to referee. No, I'm not going to referee. You know, I'll come in and, you know, shake your hand and then go out, but I'm not going to be a part of any angle or nothing. You know, I just don't want to do it.
Well, it was the old story about knowing when you need to get out, when was the right time and when it made sense.
I teased
Greg at Vern's funeral that it was a good thing they didn't do a 10 count with the bell, because Vern would have heard the bell and been back up because he couldn't leave.
Oh, God.
So let me ask you this question.
That's a great one, George.
That might have been the best thing I've ever heard you say, George.
I don't know if Greg got it when I said it, but it was true. So you go into the ring every night during your career, and you're in with all of these guys that, you know, you respect them. You're taking care of each other in the ring. I want you to tell me, was there ever one wrestler? Think a little bit. One wrestler that you just said, I just don't want to work with this guy because I can't trust him or it just doesn't work. Did you ever have anyone like that you just wanted to not go in the ring with? And then to the reverse of it, who would you like to wrestle every night?
Well, Jim Neidhart was that. He was 5'9" and 270 pounds. He was a very powerful guy. He came from a very wealthy family. He got thrown out of about three colleges. He beat up one of the coaches at UCLA and he was a shot putter and he was just impossible to work with because he was a chemical, you know, he was abusing chemicals and he wasn't rational in the ring. And it was pretty hard, you know, to try to deal with him. And, you know, he had a great partner, you know, in Bret Hart, who I really enjoyed working with. Bret Hart and I had a couple draws in the Garden, Madison Square Garden, and also at the Philly Spectrum that were, I mean, the matches afterwards, they had a hard time following them because they were really good. And, you know, I, you know, but I can tell you the guys, you know, I had opportunities. I worked with Harley Race. I did three draws with him. I did three draws with Nick. Mm-hmm. I did three draws with Ric Flair. I did two draws with Jimmy Snuka. And believe it or not, I did a draw with Khosrow Waziri, and it tested my professionalism. And I'll tell you this, this happened in the Mid-Atlantic. Khosrow had beat me on TV with this gimmick boot. I had the Mid-Atlantic championship belt. I don't know if you know of this, but he taps his foot, boom, and it was loaded, and he kicks me, he covers me, one, two, three. Yeah. So a week later, I have a match with him on TV. I put the sleeper on him, boom. The bell rings. I put the sleeper on him. He falls asleep. I take his boot off. I grab his boot. He rolls out of the ring. So I'm coming back the next week in Roanoke, Virginia, and I've got his boot. And I'm going to wear this boot, and I said, I'm going to get my title back in Roanoke. And it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then it's 7:30 or 8. We had another match in Charlotte. So I come into Roanoke, and George Scott's brother, I think it was his name.
Sandy. Angus.
Yeah, Sandy comes up to me and he says, did you get the finish? And I says, no. I said, what's the finish? And he says, George wants you to do a Broadway. I said, a Broadway? What? He says, yeah. And I said, Sandy, I said, I got Khosrow's boot. I said, he beat me illegally with the boot. Now you want me to go in the ring and wrestle him with the boot on, and I can't beat him in an hour. He says, yeah. And I says, why don't you just bury me in the middle of the ring in Roanoke, because I won't draw another freaking dime for you. So we did an hour draw.
Oh.
And honest to God, it was like pulling teeth. And Khosrow said right away, he says, Jim, I'm leading the match. I said, okay. So he called three high spots. He fucked up three of them. So he says, Jim, you lead the match. So we had a match for an hour. And then finally, the match was over. And I thought, oh, my God, that was a big test of my professionalism. That was the hardest. It was like having four root canals with no Novocaine. So after the match, we go down to Charlotte, and they want us to do another one, an hour Broadway, with the boot on again. And I told George, I said, George, I'm not doing it. I said, I'll get disqualified. And then I got fired because I told him. I said, I'm not going to do it. I said, it's absolutely ridiculous. I said, you're the worst freaking booker in the world. I said, what are you trying to do, bury me in North Carolina? I said, if you want to bury me, let me go back to Minnesota. You know, and that was the truth. So he fired me, and I left, and I went to Georgia for a little bit, and then I wound up going to Japan with Nick.
Oh, my God. I'm crying here.
So reverse it now. Who would you have liked to work every night with? It was the epitome of could give you a great match.
Well, I'd say Nick, but I don't think I could physically do it every night because he'd beat the crap out of me. I tell you, Bret Hart was excellent in the ring. Bobby Orton was incredible. I mean, the timing. Bobby Orton, to me, I thought was, out of my generation, he was the best. He was by far the best. And you look at his kid right now, Randy. Who is by far the best in the WWF. You know, and he's made a fortune there, God rest. I tell you, I worked with Kurt Hennig, God rest his soul, three or four times in New York when he first came in. And Kurt was a marvelous worker. He would have, you know, he just was scratching the surface, and Vince liked him, you know, and it was just horrible, you know, the outcome of, you know, him dying the way he did. It was sad, and another example of, you know, abuse in the wrestling profession. You know, there was a lot of guys that could have gone either way.
Yeah, sadly, that was 19 years ago, the other day that Kurt left us.
Oh, God.
Jim, I'm going to do one of those quick
first-word deals?
One-word answers. You
know, boy.
But prior to that, I would just to piggyback on what you said about Bob Orton Jr., when you and I had the distinct pleasure of working in the American Wrestling Federation.
Yes.
You know, the my residuals dried up. I don't know about you.
I still get the red jacket. Not downstairs, and the lapels are that way. You know, the damn thing fits me, but I'd have to be a clown to wear it.
You were making the big money. But I remember Bob Orton and Bob Orton Jr. and Tito wrestle in the finals of the tournament they put on. And I'm telling you, even at that point in both their careers, that was a freaking clinic. They were that smooth. They were that good.
Well, Tito was the best Hispanic wrestler, bar none, in my era. He was incredible. He was very good. And
Hell of a guy.
Yeah, hell of a guy. And, you know, he's still in New Jersey. And, you know, his wife has got a hair salon. And both of his boys went to Ivy League schools and have graduated. And, you know, he was coaching. I think he's retired now. But, you know, he was, And I remember him telling me, as a young kid, his family used to come up from Texas, his whole family, and they used to pick fruit in Wisconsin for the whole summer and then go back.
Man, success story. Good for you.
And he's also his real name is Merced Solis. Yeah. What a beautiful name. A great guy too, and I call him once in a while, and he says, "Oh, you're still alive?" I said, "Yeah, you too."
Isn't that great when you get to that point where you're just thrilled to hear a guy answer the phone?
Oh God! Well, like Hillbilly Jim says, he says, "Don't be doing no shit." He says, "You know," he said, "you could tip over anytime."
Thanks for the confidence.
Yeah.
All right, let's do just a few quick. Chris, how are we doing on time?
Oh, I mean, we're at 45 minutes, and you know what? If we want to go over, we can go over.
Perfect. All right. So we got word association here, Jim. Let's rapid fire here. First thoughts that come to mind: Larry Hennig,
the Axe.
Yep. Did you enjoy working with Larry?
Oh no. He used to beat the crap out of me. And I remember one night where we were working and he asked me, he says, "How much money did you make last week?" And I told him, I said, $900. And then he kicked me or hit me and he says, "Learn how to earn it." You know? And I used to call him Dad. And I could tell you a joke. I better not tell it, but it's a story about him. And I don't know. I could tell it, but.
You got to know it now.
Okay. We're at the Air Host, and I just started. So and they had a piano bar there, and I think John Sullivan, he was a funny guy, Johnny Valiant. Oh, God rest his soul. So he's playing the piano, and they had hamburgers and everything. So we had a couple beers and everything, and Larry and I are in the room next to each other. So we're leaving the bar, and we're walking down the hallway, and we see down the – there's a door open and we hear a lot of noise. So as we're walking in, Larry Hennig sticks his head in the door and Ray Stevens has got this girl and she's naked and he's giving her an airplane spin. And all of a sudden she lets out and urinates and the urine hits Larry right across the forehead and it hits him. And I looked at him and he looked at me and he says, "Can you believe that?" and this was probably my first month of working in the business. I said, "Oh my God!" And then Ray was laughing so hard he dropped this girl on her head, and she was inebriated. And then the next day I saw her at the front office, and she came up and apologized. She says, "Jimmy, I'm so embarrassed." And I said, "Oh God, please don't say anything more." But you know, if you tell a story like that, people say you're crazy, but it happened. And poor Larry, he got hit right across the forehead and he turned and looked at me just cold as heck. And he says, "Do you believe that?"
What else are you going to say at that point, Jim?
I know it. Oh, God. I didn't tell my mom and dad about that story, though.
That is phenomenal. Oh, God. All right. Another name. You mentioned him earlier on. Ken Patera. Thoughts on Ken?
The Last Angry Man.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
He's a brilliant guy, though. He was a brilliant guy, very smart. And, you know, he's got his master's, and Kenny is his own worst enemy. You know, he was an incredible athletic talent, probably the strongest man I had ever seen. He used to pick me up from the corner. There's no lie. And he'd pick me up from one corner, and he'd throw me across the ring in a slam, and I'd hit on my back, and my leg would be in the rope. You know, he'd throw me all the way across the ring, and he says, "Are you ready?" And I said, "Oh, God, yes." And here he'd go, you know, away he'd go.
Good God. All right. On the Ken Patera front, continuing along the same lines, our good buddy Sheik Adnan LKC.
Oh, God, he's the only guy I ever hurt in the ring. I broke his leg. I broke his leg in Austin, Minnesota. And we had done this finish two or three times. And he stopped me in a comeback. And he went to throw me in. And he went to backdrop me. And I was going to small package him. And we'd done this, I don't know, three or four times. So we're working in Austin. Boom, 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 boom. And Wisconsin.
Lacrosse.
So we're working. We do the finish. I make a comeback. He stops me, throws me, and he goes to backdrop me. And I go to hook him for, you know, a small package. And I stick my leg in between his leg. And I pull forward, you know, and he leans forward. And the son of a gun leaned backwards. And my leg hooked his leg. And when he went back, I heard pop. And he said, I covered him 1, 2, 3. And he says, "You son of a bitch, you broke my leg." And he starts crawling on his hands across the ring. And I looked at him and I almost started laughing. I did. I had to hold my face like that. So Jack Lanza runs out into the ring. He's the agent. And he says, "Jesus Christ, what happened?" I says, "I think he broke his leg." He says, "Oh, no." He says, "He's working with Vern in the main event at the St. Paul Civic Center." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry." And I apologized to Adnan. I says, "Adnan, how many times have we done that finish?" And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, you know, you roll forward, not backwards."
Have you seen him recently?
I saw him at a show 3 or 4 years ago, and he looks pretty good.
Oh, he looks tremendous.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the one up in Mendota Heights or West St. Paul at the school up there, because I was there with you. Yeah.
Yeah, and he comes all the way from Hawaii.
Yeah.
And he was a character. Honest to God, he was a character. He counted his money. He probably knew every nickel he had, you know, and I remember he had married a younger woman, and I think he might have had a child with her or something. And I said to him, I says, "Adnan," I says, "what would happen?" And he was in trouble with the IRS for a little bit. So he put all of his money into her account. And I said to him, I says, "Adnan," I says, "what would happen if your wife would leave you?" And he says, "I have to shoot myself." And he was serious.
Oh, God. All right. I'm going to speed through a couple more of these.
Okay.
Jerry Blackwell.
Very talented for a big man. Very talented. Nice guy. Here's another guy who I goofed up. We're in a match with him in some small. And
I think
we
should have seen the bloopers here.
God, in River Falls. We're wrestling in River Falls on a spot show. And the crowd was going, rah, 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 you know. So he says, "Okay, Jimmy," he says, "throw me outside." So he says, "We'll get this crowd going." So I throw him outside and he grabs a chair. So he says, stop me, take the chair and hit him over the head. So he comes to the ropes and I go, wham, and I had the chair the wrong way. And I split him wide open here. So he looks at me and I put my hand over my face and I said, oh, Jesus. And he comes back in the ring and he said, Jimmy, he says, we're only going to make $150 for this shot. And it's going to cost me $500 to get sold out.
Oh, man. Well, you pretty much took care of Sheik's army then, didn't you?
Oh, God. You know, and that was the last time I ever worked with him, too.
Yeah. Okay, I got two more names for you.
Okay.
Wally Carbo.
Wally Carbo. I'll never forget the time I walked into Wally Carbo's office, and he was smiling. And I said, Wally, I said, why are you smiling? And he says, oh, Jim, he says, have you ever heard of Commando Penance? And I said, yeah, a little bit. And he says, yeah. He says, that's where, you know, you go to church and the priest just wants you to say one sin, confess to one sin, and then you're entirely forgiven for all the sins you committed. So I said to him, I said, Wally, I says, well, what sin did you confess to the priest? And he says, I told him I missed Mass on Sunday.
Well, that would have been good.
Oh my God, I fell over backwards laughing. You know, he was a. Oh my God, how about his funeral? Were you guys at his funeral with the?
We
with
were.
His,
yes.
With the two families were there. Thank God. Oh, Uncle Wally.
I think it was Stan Basilak, because Wally had the open coffin for a while when we were there, and he had this shit-eating grin on his face while in the coffin, you know, and Mace like said, you know, this either he's working us or what's going on? Or is he going to sit up or what's going on? He was, you know what, if he would have, he could have bent that priest's ear for like months. Can you imagine that with the Wally Carbo story?
Oh, God.
Yeah, they would have abolished communions after Wally spent it in the...
I remember, I'll never forget when I got married, we had a big wedding, you know, and it was at the prom center. And I remember I got a gift from Wally and his wife. So we opened it up and I said, what is that? And then Mary said, it's an egg cooker. I thought, oh. You know, you could put four eggs in it and cook it. And I thought, geez, that's a hell of a gift.
Boy, he was splurging.
Oh, I know it.
It might have been hot too.
Well, it might have been hot. Either that or
you never know. He had to unload it, Jimmy.
Well, either that or see.
It was either that or you were getting a television set.
Yeah, one with half an antenna.
Well, then you get it just on the east side of the river instead of
that's
the west.
Right. I wind up with Wisconsin TV, no Minnesota.
Oh my
that's
God!
Great.
I can't breathe. All right. Last name. I know this guy is so dear to all of us, and I'm sure you're no exception. Kenny J.
Kenny, you know, wonderful guy, great personality, great family. And, you know, he's rolled with the punches for so many years. He was at Crusher Fest with us. With his wife and family, and it was a good time, and you know, and then he had his book. He had a book that he wrote, and he gave it to me. I have it someplace, and you know, he's a living legend for, you know, being in the AWA, and God rest George Kadaski. You know, honest to God, those two guys. You know, a lot of people still ask about them.
Sure,
you know? Yeah,
absolutely.
Oh, Kenny was a good guy.
Wonderful sweetheart. Just a wonderful guy, you know. And I think Kenny's got his 85th birthday coming up. And
God bless him.
Eddie Sharkey just turned 86. It's like, what the hell's going on here? You know, it's crazy. Crazy.
Well, I hope I know my name when I'm 82. I'll be 73 in August, and I thought, oh God, every day I get up, I said, Lord, thanks for the gift.
You know, I remember on this line, Baron Von Raschke, Jim Raschke at Cauliflower Alley Club. There, it was tradition that they would read the names of the guys that passed away the year before. And I remember sitting at the table with Barron, and he's listening intently, and he says, I just want to make sure I'm not on the list.
And, you know, he's the last guy left, really, from that group. Yeah. And I talked to him once in a while. I call him, you know, and I saw him. I think I saw him last summer or maybe two summers ago. But he looks good. You know, he's 82 years old. And,
One of his greatest lines, Barron's lines about dying, was when we were out to dinner with a group of people after one of Mick's Saturday Night at Ringside shows, and Barron said that this is many years ago now, 30 years ago, but Barron says, you know, he hopes that he doesn't have to be he says when Vern dies, he says, I'm going to have to be a pallbearer because I need the money. It's just. He's a great guy.
He's a wonderful guy. And you know, him and Bonnie still make those trips. And I've called him, you know, and told him, I said, hey, there's an opportunity here. And, you know, those opportunities are drying up, you know. And it's just, you know, I feel that, you know, I feel very fortunate that there's an opportunity, you know, for me who's, you know, I've been out of the business, I don't know, since I was, you know, 50. Well, you know, 45, 50, you know, almost 30 years. And there's still people that, you know, will come up to me and they'll say, are you Jim Brunzell? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, I remember this and I remember that. And I'm out in the yard mowing the yard. And all of a sudden the guy pulls up and asks me for an autograph. And I said, hey, let me, you know, so I stopped. I got a little rider now, you know. So, and I jumped out and, you know, got a picture for him. And actually, I just wound up sending my book to Springsteen's manager, John Landau. He's got two managers, John Landau and Barbara Carr. And I'm trying. There it is. Thank you. Thank you, George. Yeah. I've done pretty well with that book.
I love the book.
It's been since 2016.
There you go.
And you know what? I got to tell you, honestly, there's a lady who does critiques, and her name's Marianne Grossman, and she does it for the St. Paul Pioneer Press.
Right.
So I sent her the book, and then I said, hey, I said, I'm a local guy. I said, you know, I'm from White Bear Lake, went to the University of Minnesota, parlayed that into a 27-year, you know, professional wrestling career. I said, it might not be as glamorous as Scott Studwell's book, but I think it would be merit if you could take a look at it. So, and then she emails me back and she says, I've got all these books to do. So then, you know, every other week I'll type in and I'll say, okay, when's my time coming up? You know, I'd love to have her do the book. Matter of fact, I've been approached for doing a second book and people want me to do a tell-all book, you know, which I never do. And, you know, because I just wouldn't want to do that.
Jim, that's what I found the most appealing about your book. First of all, it's an easy read and, you know, the stories are just great. And you did not come across as a guy with an axe to grind.
Yeah.
You know, so many of the books have the books that, you know, where they're taking a shot at somebody. But your book isn't like that. And I highly recommend it. Great, great read.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. You know, it was fun to do, and I wrote every word of it, and then Mary put it together, and all those pictures were, you know, my own pictures. And George, you probably had a couple pictures in there, too.
I had about 15 or 16 of them in there.
Really, thank you. Well, I hope I gave you credit.
You did, and I was going to say to you, piggybacking on what Mick said, you know, you have not went out and buried guys, and I have to tell you, Jimmy, and I'll do this publicly, I felt honored when you were writing your book that you sent me several of the stories in an email and you asked me several times, do you think this is okay to say this, or should I change this, or should I not use it? And that made me feel good because that tells me you're a class guy. And I thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, my parents were so good to me. You know, they gave me everything I needed to nurture me, and my dad gave me a football after, you know, I like in the book I said I wanted to be just like Elvis Presley, and be a guitar player. And my dad was a Navy man. So what he did, he took me to the music store and bought me an accordion. So I was going to be, you know, Myron Florin from Lawrence Welk, you know. So I did that for about 6 weeks, and then I found the football.
Good choice.
Yes.
I want to say one last thing here before Chris goes into the wrap up. Jim, you had mentioned about being recognized, you know, when you're out there mowing the lawn or what have you. When we started this venture, talking about the AWA podcast, you can't believe how many people are absolutely drooling and chopping at the bit to relive the AWA days. You know, everybody's so spoiled now. You know, the current generation has no idea, you know, of what it was like in the territory.
Exactly.
You know, and I mean, to me, just having you on the show has been such a kick. I mean, love this.
It's fun, you know, to reminisce with you and George and have Chris there too, you know, because it was a very special time in pro wrestling. And what Vince has done and what AWE or whatever it is has done, they've totally created something completely different. There is no baby face. There is no heel. There is no weakness. Everybody is a braggadocious this. And you watch it and you think, oh, my God. And, you know, so it's a sin to show any weakness or to be a heel. And I just, when I watch some of this stuff, and then I see this guy, his name's Cassidy Orange. Have you seen this guy?
Orange Cassidy.
Yeah. Oh, my God. When I saw that guy do that little kick and then these guys sell it, and I said, oh, my God. I said, what in the world? What is going on? And I have a friend from Winnipeg, Don Callis, who works for AWE. Sure. And he's Kenny something. He's a manager, and he's a smart guy, and he's a great worker, real good worker. And he's managed to, you know, he worked for Vince a couple, 3 or 4 years, and then he worked down there. And his girlfriend became pregnant, so he asked the boss if he could, you know, spend some time with her because she was going to have this ultrasound. And their boss down there, the con guy,
Tony Khan.
Yeah, he said to him, he says, take as much time as you need.
Wow. Boy.
That wouldn't happen from Vince, and it wouldn't happen from Vern. Matter of fact, Vern told me, he says, don't tell anybody you're married. That's what he said.
Really? I figure that was with the women, but I would never figure that that would be with the men. It's like, don't tell anybody your marital status.
Oh, it was merchandise sales, right, Jim? They wanted to buy the stuff, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, he wanted those young girls to come to the matches in hopes of maybe they might score, you know, they might, you know, somewhere have, you know, whoever it was being their knight and, you know, with a black mask on and yellow mask. And
they could wind up like that girl in Illinois getting the airplane spin.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I hope she's still alive. She'll probably never. God, you know, that was so damn funny. Honest to God. And that Larry Henning, he'll never.
Could you beat that?
Oh, I don't think that's pretty doggone.
Oh,
that's one in a million.
Tremendous.
So is there anything we missed here, Jim? Is there anything else that you guys want to cover before we go ahead and wrap this thing up? I think you guys, I mean, this has been great. I've just been sitting back just enjoying the hell out of this. I mean, this has been fun just hearing you guys reminisce. I mean, it's, I don't know.
Well, I am so blessed. I've had a wonderful wife who was, you know, when I was gone all that time, enabled our kids to have normal lives. Both my kids have become very successful. They both have their degrees. My daughter works, Jennifer, she's got two very active, athletic, tremendous soccer players at Centennial. And my son, Jimmy, this is his second run as a film festival director, and he's in Oxford, Mississippi. Holy Jesus. And I said, Jim, take those Minnesota license plates off your truck, for God's sake. You know, but he loves it down there. And I've just been so blessed. And, I, you know, the fact that Mary you know, when I was gone all that time, I mean, it really, you know, you go through all the stuff, but your wife, she's taken hold of the family. And I just feel so blessed, you know, to have such a great life. And I know I've had some, you know, these injuries and these surgeries, but, you know, it could have been a lot worse. So every day, you know, I thank the good Lord for my blessings.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate Jim. I appreciate, you know, Mick and George being able to reach out to you. And hopefully this is the first of many times we'll be able to, you know, sit here and bullshit, or you guys bullshit, and I'll just sit here and listen. So this has been great, man. Thank you.
Well, the next time I get on, I'll have to tell something that's true. I'm just kidding.
No, that wouldn't be fair.